Good evening. There we go. All right. We are going to get started, and we are going to have to fly. I did not get to hear all of the announcements, but I am very afraid that Chris just announced that we're going to have a modified service of some kind next Wednesday night. Like, I need more Wednesday nights, not less. More Wednesday nights, Chris, not less. You're killing me. All right, that's okay. We will fly. That technically leaves us with just one Wednesday night together after tonight. Unless, like I said, I beg, borrow, or steal a couple of Wednesdays from the next teacher to be able to finish those out, this book out, kind of in a way that would benefit everyone the most. We are going to polish up or finish up our lesson on metaphors. Last week, we spent a lot of time talking specifically about metaphors. We discussed that it's probably something that we end up using a whole lot more than we realize. We probably use metaphors a lot more than we realize day to day. We also use things that are similar to metaphors. We might call those similes or personification, different things like that. But we talked about Jesus's metaphors, the ones specifically that Jesus used to make an influence on people and to change the way people thought about things. That was kind of the premise, was that if we want to change the way we think on things, then a well-placed metaphor might be that very thing that can do it. We talked specifically about one metaphor that Jesus used, and it changed the way that the people saw the religious leaders of the day, which is going to be interesting because we're going to talk about those in the next lesson as well. But what was the metaphor? Jesus referred to the leaders of the day as whitewashed tombs. And we talked about how that was a scandalous statement. And we keep using that term. And, you know, we talk about the term provocative and how we don't mean that in a sexual way. We mean that in a way that evokes thought. And it causes us to think differently. And it provocates different images. It forces us to think about something. That's what the term provocative means. It causes us to feel a certain way. It doesn't necessarily have a sexual connotation to it. And we talked about that a wise metaphor can do just that. It changes something that we've seen time and time again. Think about how often those people would have seen the Pharisees and the scribes and the Sadducees and the different sects of religious groups there, and how it would have changed something that they had seen over and over again. Maybe that's why Jesus used so many metaphors when he referred to himself as well. Another way Jesus used metaphors was to refer to himself. He wanted to give the people of the day and us a fresh perspective about how to experience God. And he wanted us to have a fresh experience about him, and maybe even to change the way they thought about the Messiah. We talked about this when we discussed the cast of the cross, but had you ever considered that Jesus wasn't the first person to claim to be the Messiah? Think about how people had access to the scriptures. The chief priests, they would have had access to the information that told that a Messiah was coming. Jesus might have been the 22nd in line of people claiming to have been the Messiah. And so they hear, oh yeah, yeah, the Messiah, Jesus, yeah, we got you. And Jesus says, no, I'm not sure you understand. So let me change the way you think about the Messiah. And as we already know, since he's the wisest teacher ever, Jesus uses a lot of metaphors for all different learning styles. You know, that's something that didn't become popular in this country, I'm going to even say in the last 20 or 30 years, teaching to different learning styles. Jesus has been doing that for years. Years and years. Listen to how he referred to himself. He calls himself the Good Shepherd, a kind guide. He's the gate and the door, something through which we need to go. He's the bread of life, something one would take in for nourishment. He's the vine, something to which we branches must remain connected. Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, a person we need to follow if we want our life to be sustained. Jesus used tons of metaphors when referring to himself. Jesus also did the same with ideas like faith and the kingdom. He often used metaphors with both. Think about the number of times that Jesus says, the kingdom of heaven is like, And he fills in the blank multiple times. All right? He goes on and on to talk about that. Faith, he compared to a mustard seed. Why? You only need a little to do a lot. By using the smallest seed, which produces the biggest tree, our understanding is made clear. You don't understand about faith? Let me make it plain for you. It only takes a little to do a lot. What do you mean, Jesus, it only takes a little to do a lot? You're speaking cryptically. Okay, I just need you to have the amount of a mustard seed, and it'll produce like you've never seen before. He was great at making his understanding clear. For the kingdom, he chose many metaphors, comparing it to a pearl of great price or a treasure in a field. He wanted no questions left when considering the significance of the kingdom. Paul was also skilled at using metaphor. So even though Jesus was the master metaphor user, Paul also used metaphors many times. To what did Paul famously compare the Christian life? A race. That should be the one that I would think would come to your mind quickest. It would be a race. In order to exhort them to make their faith a priority, Paul connected it metaphorically to something common in Greek culture, and that was racing and athletics. The Greek were a very sporty group. We don't have to look far to see that with the Olympics and the different heritage involved in that particular sport. But in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 24, he talks about how, you know, all run the race, but only one receives the prize. Does this kind of metaphor matter? Does it matter that he chose that particular metaphor? Yes, I think it does. When we think of our faith journey as a race, we are more likely to press forward instead of snoozing. And the author talked about it as the tortoise and the hare. You know, a lot of people approach their faith race like the hare. I'm doing fine. I've been doing great. Let me relax just a little bit. And it ended up costing that particular hare the race in the story of Aesop's fable. But in the other sense, Paul expresses it as, hey, you need to keep your foot on the gas as far as faith is concerned. You need to run with the intention of winning that prize. Don't give up. Don't quit. Don't lay it down. Don't take a nap. No snoozing. Keep your foot on the gas, and let's keep moving. He also used metaphors to keep all of us right in right relation to one another. Does anybody remember the metaphor for that? He used the metaphor to keep all of us in right relationship with each other. Do you remember the metaphor? This one might be a little trickier. Say it again. No, that wasn't exactly what I had, but you're probably wouldn't be too far off if you kept thinking. In 1 Corinthians 12, 21 and 22, Paul uses the metaphor of the body. They were rife with arrogance and pride, thinking only of themselves as better than those around them. So what did he do? Paul offers a correctional metaphor through a context that everyone has, a body. He reminds them that though it's made up of many parts, it's still one body designed and connected by God. You know, we're different people, all of us, and we're all valuable, and we all create the body. And without any one of us, the body is incomplete. And so if without any part of the body, our human body, our body is incomplete as well. All right? Let's see here. There are many other metaphors that Paul used. He talked about the yeast and the dough, the armor of God. These aren't just poetic statements. They're intentional comparisons. Metaphors show us that this was a neat statement. The metaphor shows us that the world is full of cousins, which is technically a metaphor about metaphors, if you want to get literal about it. But it just reminds us that everything's connected. Everything's related and relatable. You know, we used to have a joke in college and with some youth minister buddies, and we've got a pretty awesome youth minister in our group right now. But we used to have the who can make a metaphor about that. And we'd think of something hard. It'd be like a barbecue sandwich. And we'd challenge a youth minister to make a metaphor about a barbecue sandwich. And somehow, you know, and some of it was in jest and being a little silly, but it was just the idea that everything's connected. If we try hard enough, we could make a metaphor about that chair sitting right there and how it's doing its job. It's holding us up, or whatever you wanted to insert there. But the point is that a metaphor can do a lot. It can show us that everything's related. the connections between things can mean the difference between influencing someone or not influencing them. It could be the difference between a change in their behavior and more of the same. The difference between getting on God's agenda or remaining on their own agenda. All right? So that kind of finishes us up on metaphors, I think. Let me glance here real quick. All right, good deal. So that kind of finishes up. Any questions or thoughts on metaphors? And that kind of actually completely finishes up the reframing the way they think section, or reframing the situation where we talked about metaphors, we talked about telling a story, and creating a contrast. Those were the three ways to reframe the situation. Okay? So now we're going to move into another section that's exceptionally important, and it's the idea of offering compelling evidence. Okay? Maybe you're a I gotta see it to believe it kind of person. I'm that way to a certain degree. It could be, you know, joshing with a bunch of the kids, and you know, one of the kids says, "Oh, I dunked on a 10-foot goal," and you know, the kid's 5'2" and he hadn't played basketball in 2 years. I'm gonna need to see it. Okay, let's go down into the basketball, go there, and you can just show me. Okay, I need you to offer me compelling evidence. I need you to do something that's going to make me go, yeah, okay, I believe you. And that's what we're going to be talking about. And this section is also divided into three sections. Again, with the limited number of Wednesday nights that we have, I'm not exactly sure how far into this section that we'll make it. But as far as, as far as this section and where it fits, this has kind of been our overall theme here. We talked about before we say a word. We talked about, developing a relationship that has respect in it. We talked about reframing the situation. And now we're going to offer compelling evidence. And those should be 10, 11, and 12. All right. Do you consider yourself a skeptic? Think about that question for just a second. Now, I'm not necessarily talking about in reference to Christianity or spirituality. But do you consider yourself a skeptic? What are some things that people are commonly skeptical of? This will be a fun little 2 or 3 minute discussion. I think it's worth it. Okay, miracle drugs. Okay, you hear it on the radio all the time. You know, I took this pill for 30 days and I lost 95 pounds. Okay, and maybe some people do have that kind of success. I don't know, maybe they gain it all back. I don't know. Okay, so, all right, skeptical about maybe some, you know, sketchy pharmaceutical stuff. What else? Aliens. All right, now, I love it, Mr. Daniel. Let's just dive right in both feet to conspiracy theories, right? I love it. All right, I'm going to need some more time tonight. What did you say, Pam? Yeah, I'm that way, too, about a lot of stuff. You know, yeah, here, just take it. Why? What's wrong with it? When do you want it back? All those different kinds of things. And Danny mentioned aliens and conspiracy theories. And y'all, I've watched some videos before, and I've seen some stuff that makes me question a lot of stuff. Okay? There are people out there. My Grammy's mother, Dorothy Baker, she's no longer living, to this day, or to the day she died, did not believe that anyone stepped foot on the moon for any reason ever. And now some of y'all are giggling. We may have some folks here that are still thinking that way. And that's, hey, I understand that. There are conspiracy theorists regarding 9/11. And did it actually happen? There are conspiracy theorists about everything. But let's maybe stray away from conspiracy theories to maybe some more practical everyday stuff. What about the salesman that knocks on your door and wants to try to sell you something? And he wants to sell it to you dirt cheap, and it's going to last forever, and you're never going to have to buy another one. Are we skeptical sometimes about products that are going to last? Sir, if it's too good to be true, it probably is. Okay? And I think that's okay. Like, I don't think that makes you necessarily like a bad person. I don't think it means that, that means you doubt or you don't trust people. I think it's okay to be skeptical about a lot of things. I would encourage you to be skeptical about some of the religious teaching that is in the world. There's a lot of information out there, a lot of misinformation that's out there. And we need to be skeptical. And we need to compare things to God's Word. Okay? I think in all of us are skeptical about some things. I think in some ways we are all skeptical about some things. You may be skeptical about some trivial things. You may be skeptical about some in-depth things. You may be the opposite. You just believe everything. Okay? But we really shouldn't be surprised to find that some are skeptical regarding religion and Christianity. That's something that is, number one, been around since time began and since Jesus' day, and is something that's going to remain around. Okay, it's not going anywhere. Some people are skeptical about Christianity because of the Christians that they know. Some people are skeptical about Christianity because of the Christians that they know. They're skeptical about religion. You know, God's referred to as the sky bully, and he's referred to as, the man upstairs who, runs everything. Oh, there are people out there that are very skeptical about some things. Despite the power of the many influence principles, we've discussed 9 principles that we can use on people to influence them. Have you thought about the fact that you might try all 9 and still not be able to influence them? That's kind of discouraging. You'd think one of those 9 would have an effect on them in some way, but maybe not. Maybe they need just a little bit more. It still may not be enough at times, and you might borrow from all of the influence principles to be able to get to some folks. Many like us, may insist on solid, reliable evidence before they embrace new ideas or behaviors. I'm that way. Listen, I want to see that this is going to work. One of the things that I get asked all the time about the particular way that I work out, well, why did you go with that way of working out? Because it worked for me. It may not work for you, but it worked for me. It provided me evidence that this was going to do something for me, so it was why I stuck with that. Remember that the people we're trying to influence are marinated in today's culture. They are constantly marinated in a culture that tells them that they're ignorant if they believe in God, that tells them that a loving God would never punish people, that all these different kinds of things that I know you intelligent folks don't believe. But they're marinated in that culture, and our job is to influence them. We will see that Jesus used evidence with great success, and as always, we will follow his lead. Long ago, before people became enlightened or modern or even postmodern, as you think about the different theories of how practical thinking and modern thinking is organized, before any of that, Jesus was using evidence principles to persuade and change hearts and minds. There are 3 types of evidence-based influence. Okay? There's authoritative, experiential, and social. Authoritative, experiential, and social. And we're going to tackle authoritative evidence this evening. I don't mean to be cliche, but I do want you to do this for me. If you don't mind, just close your eyes for just a second. And I want you to consider, paint a picture, use colors, use things you've seen in your past to picture a religious leader in Jesus' time. What does it look like? Think about him being adorned with the different things that he would be adorned with special clothing, pristine robes, fancy tassels, hair and beard perfectly combed and groomed, They've got the scriptures bound to their foreheads in phylacteries. Open your eyes. What would you think if you saw a person like that today? If you saw a person dressed just as a religious leader would have been dressed in the first century of Israel. Can you see this spectacle walking down the street in first century Israel? Can you see them scoffing at others and elevating themselves as they pompously parade down the street? Because believe me, they were caught up in the pride and the arrogance of their position. They were caught up in it big time. Can you imagine what it would have looked like to our modern eyes to see the scribes, Pharisees, and religious leaders? It would have probably looked more like Halloween. And I thought to myself, I wonder if I could get away with coming as a Pharisee to Halloween one year. And then I thought, I just don't think I want to do that. It doesn't sound very fun because of the negativity that's associated with those kinds of religious leaders. And we're already probably doing it in our minds. We're probably going, why were these guys leaders? Why were they considered leaders? Okay, and we're going to come to that. These men were leaders, and the supposed, and I should have put my air quotes around leaders because they were not true leaders, and the supposed gateway to heaven, leading their followers into an oppressive and burdensome lifestyle that alienated people from God and one another. They're supposed to be the connection to God. And instead of being the connection to God, they're alienating people from God. They're taking them further away from God. If you believe Jesus, like I hope you believe Jesus, then his indictment of them makes them out to be scoundrels of the worst kind. Here's what Jesus said about these religious leaders that we just pictured in our mind. And these excerpts are taken from Matthew chapter 23, when he quotes or speaks what we commonly call the woes to the scribes and the Pharisees. This was the chapter of woes. They tie up heavy loads that are hard to carry and put them on people's shoulders, but they aren't willing to lift a finger to move them. They do everything to be observed by others. You lock up the kingdom of heaven from people. You don't go in, and you don't allow those entering to go in. You devour widows' houses and make long prayers just for show. They are full of greed and self-indulgence. You are full of hypocrisy and lawlessness. So that's what Jesus thought about them. He doesn't pull any punches. That's what Jesus thought about these religious leaders here in the first century. The chief priests were the chief impediment to people's relationships with God. They were the chief impediment. Not surprisingly, Jesus condemns this group with metaphors, if you'll remember, as snakes and a brood of vipers. We shake our heads and wonder how. Why? Why follow such pompous hypocrites who repaid allegiance with affliction? Why be influenced by such people? And all we can come back on is authority. Because they had authority of some kind. Now, thankfully, God sent Christ, and Christ exposed them and identified himself as the true authority. You know, if you think about the idea of authority, it's a very interesting concept. It's a very interesting concept. These men were considered authorities on interpretations and all things spiritual. Because of these men, they willingly followed them into a life of misery and hardship, as we've already mentioned. Simply stated, rightly or wrong, people usually follow authority and those who offer expert advice. Of course, we recognize this, that this can be used for good and for evil. And in the case of the scribes and the Pharisees and the religious leaders of the day, they used it for evil. They used their authority for evil. And I would say to you that as far as leaders in general is concerned, that this is a fact that's as current as it ever could be in our society. We've got people who are willing to throw their allegiance and their confidence behind political figures when those political figures would fit perfectly with the description that Jesus just used to condemn the scribes and the Pharisees. They get elevated. They get lifted up. Because what? They passed a law that we liked. There's a lot to consider there. And I'm as guilty of it as anybody from time to time. We recognize that this can be used for good and evil, and it's a fact that's as current as it ever could be in our American society. But before we get to this too much, let's unpack this idea a little bit more. I've only got about 9 minutes left. I may actually make it through this slide. From early childhood, most of us are conditioned to respect authority in some shape, form, or fashion. This book was copywritten originally in 1999. It was republished in 2002. And if he republishes it again, I might ask him to consider taking this statement out. Because as a teacher who's around kids every day, I can 100% tell you that for this audience, that statement may be true. But for generations that are behind me, and behind even our teenagers, this statement rings less true every year. It rings less true every year. I have students who are literally not taught to respect authority of any kind. So some of the statements in this book here are predicated upon having a family environment where you were taught to respect the different types of authority that there are. Not necessarily always agreeing with them. My parents taught me never to argue with my teacher, but that if she said something that I didn't like, to use my manners and bring it home to them, and we'd take care of it. Because you're not going to go to school for... Go ahead. Could be. Or less Christian behavior. He asked the question, he said, could it be that I see this trend because there are less Christians in the world? And it's possible. Or it simply could be that even though many hide behind the phrase of Christian, we're rarely truly acting like a Christian. I think a lot of my kids' parents at schools would say, oh yeah, I'm a Christian. Are you sure you're a Christian? Are you sure you are? Because there's a few things that I'd like to talk to you about if you are. But this idea here is that hopefully, some of my kids do. Please, I teach 400 students. Not all 400 of my students are what I'm describing. But ask some other folks who work in public education and they'll tell you the numbers are interesting. The numbers are interesting. Okay? You know, here are some examples. Parents, teachers, police officers, preachers, and the list goes on and on. For the most part, when you're six, there's tons of people to look to as an authority figure. Okay? There's tons of people. One thing we have to do in the elementary schools is we have to bring the firemen in and show the boys and girls what a fireman looks like. Because if your house is on fire and a fireman shows up, you've never seen a fireman before, what do? You panic and you run away from the big alien that just kicked your door in. Okay? So we have to teach the kids, no, they're here to help you. They wear this equipment to protect you, to protect them, and to be able to get... So some of this authority has to be taught. Okay? Some of it has to be learned. So if authorities abound when we're six, the truth of the matter is that they abound when we're 26, 36, 56, and 96. We rely on credentials, positions, titles, accomplishments, and many other things when deferring to an authority. We may deny it, but we all do it. If you go to buy a product, especially in this world, I'm willing to say there's a lot of you that do all of your shopping online. We got Black Friday coming up for Christmas shopping. There will be more sales made on Monday than are made on Friday after Thanksgiving. And which product you going to buy? You got two choices. You're going to buy the one that's got the 2-star rating. You're going to buy the one that's got the 5-star rating that 10,000 people have rated. Yeah, it's $3 or $4 more. But 10,000 authorities have told you that's the best product. And that's kind of how the authority principle works on a day-to-day level. Patty and I, when we first bought our very first house, the house that's was over behind Target, for those of you that ever went over there, we hired a guy that actually did some work at the church. And we got, I think from Ronnie, got his phone number, and we were set to meet him at the house. We had to have the floors completely restained and sanded, stained, painted. I mean, we were doing, it was a several thousand dollar job. And y'all, I kid you not, somebody who looked about as old as Zeb Green showed up. And I was like I was standing beside Patty and I went, mm-mm, mm-mm. I mean, I wasn't too old myself. I mean, I was probably 20, been married 11 years, so I was 27. But I'm talking, y'all, there wasn't a chin hair one on this dude. And believe me, I was looking. I mean, I was like. So he was in his 20s. He was 20, 21, and we walked all through the house. And, I mean, the whole time, I mean, like, I'm probably borderline rude with this guy. Not rude, but, I mean, I was standoffish. I was kind of like, you know, I was not comfortable. And Patty's asking questions or whatever. And I even think I probably mouthed to Patty. I said, Patty, this kid's what? He's a teenager. What are we doing? I'm not giving him this, you know. And so finally at the very end, Patty says, well, I hate to ask, but what do you know about hardwood floors? You look like you're 12. I mean, she's like, you know, Patty, she's going to say it. And he looked back at her and he said, what do you know about hardwood floors? And Patty and I went, can you start Monday? I wanted all this authority from him, and he didn't necessarily have it. He didn't have the credentials or the papers to make me feel better, but I couldn't answer his reply. That's exactly, y'all, if I'm lying, I'm dying. I asked him, I said, how do you know anything about hardwood floors? What do you know about hardwood floors? And he said, what do you know? And he said, you called me. And we looked at the work that he did. But we use this idea a lot more than we might realize. We use this idea of the authority principle. When we need the best course of action, we look for an expert. Maybe even subconsciously we do this. You know, we want to make our kids behave, so we get a parenting book. We want hope for a better marriage, we check out this website. We want to make that initiative at work succeed, we benchmark or check out somebody who's made it work before us. This idea is used quite often. The list goes on and on. You're buying a car, you check the ratings and reviews. You're trying to find spiritual fulfillment, we go talk to the preacher. Why? Because he's the authority. Take inventory sometimes of how often seemingly authoritative evidence allows someone's, influences someone's thinking. Here in the book were some examples. These were really interesting to me. I may not get through all of these. While the author was reading, he jotted down how many times the authority principle showed up. On the back of a book I'm reading, I found endorsements, glowing statements about the book from people with impressive titles. It's a boring book, but with authority figures like these singing the praises of the book, I feel the tug to read it a little more closely. While surfing the web, I stumbled across information intended to discourage teenagers from smoking. It cites authorities like the U.S. Surgeon General and the American Cancer Society to make its case. I hear the TV in the next, this is a big one. I hear the TV in the next room blaring about how critics are raving about how progressive and creative some new movie is. The ads trying to leverage the critics' seeming expertise, of course. And then this one was my favorite. I was about to say to one of my kids, and y'all, we've all done this, tell your brother to turn down the TV. Instead, I chose to reframe the request a bit differently. Tell your brother that Dad wants him to turn down the TV. I can't tell you how many times I've sent Emma off to do something, and I know her sister. And unless there's more authority in that statement, she's never going to do it. So if Emma just goes in and says, it's time to get ready for church, Anna's going to think, she ain't going to boss me around. She ain't mama. She ain't daddy. So I have to say it, Emma, tell Anna, Dad said it's time to get ready for church. That's the authority principle in a practical use. Two more, and then we'll be done here. Turn back to the computer to find that a professor in another department has sent me an email. The VP asked me to pull a team together to evaluate the undergraduate curriculum. Can I count on your help? I say yes, even though I don't have the time. It's the vice president, after all. Later, I glance at the newspaper. One article notes that a major study has connected workplace stress to heart disease and shorter lifespans. The study is from a leading research university, adding to the credibility of the findings. I vow to reevaluate my level of workplace stress right after I'm done with the curriculum committee assignment. All day long, we see the authority principle. Next week, we'll get to Jesus's use of the authority principle specifically. Thank you for your time. Actually, it could be 2 weeks, I think. 2 weeks. Jesus's use of the authority principle. Thank you for your time.